Okay, good to see everybody. And we are, as you know, studying the book of Proverbs in here on Wednesday nights. This is actually going to be the book of Hebrews. My wife is teaching the book of Proverbs. We'll be studying the book of Hebrews in here. And this is actually a 20-week class. We have our semesters. We have 20-week semesters, and then we have that 2-week break in between the semesters. And this last 2-week break, you found out what your personality was and what your spouse's personality was, and you're still married after figuring all that out. So that's what we did in our 2-week break this time. We won't do that next time. We'll have marriage counseling during the 2-week break next time to bring you back together. What we have is 20 weeks of a study. And many of the classes are 10 weeks in length. Most of the classes you saw on the screen will be 10 weeks. The study of Proverbs, study of church history, the character studies of the New Testament, those are 10 weeks. And after 10 weeks, there'll be some new 10-week studies. Sometimes classes are 20 weeks for the entire semester, and that's what we're doing with the book of Proverbs. In reality, you say, wow, that's a lot of time for the book of Proverbs. Why do I keep saying Proverbs? Why do I have Proverbs on? I'm going to go down the hall and teach the book of Proverbs. Why do I keep saying that? 20 weeks isn't enough time to teach the book of Proverbs either, but 20 weeks is not enough time to teach the book of Hebrews, and you might think that's ridiculous. It should be plenty of time. It only has 13 chapters. It's a book that has 300 verses in it. How much time do you think I would like to teach 300 verses? All right, 20 weeks doesn't it? And what's going to happen here is we're going to have a gospel meeting come up near the end of this. It's going to take a couple weeks. And so we actually only end up with about 17 weeks for the book of Hebrews is what we're studying here. We've got about 17 classes to cover this book. It is, while it's only 13 chapters, it is a huge book. And I hope that you have spent time in personal study of this book before. It's a lot of fun to study. It is a book that you can get down really deep in a study of this book. You don't have to. You can stay up on the surface with it and still get a lot out of it. But it is a book that, and I'll try to say this again at the end, but it is a book that brings together Old Testament and New Testament together. And it will help you to understand the New Testament better if you understand the book of Hebrews. It will help you to understand the Old Testament better if you understand the book of Hebrews. If you understand the Old Testament, you'll understand the book of Hebrews better because they are so closely tied together. So what we're going to do next week we will actually get into the first chapter of the book, but I feel compelled to talk about some introductory material to the book. It's hard to teach the book of Hebrews and not deal with some matters of introduction. But I want you to look forward to this study. I hope you will read through and study the book of Hebrews. There are a lot of good resources and study helps that you can use in studying through this book. But I hope you'll enjoy studying together. But here's one of the probably the biggest question that comes up. You study the book of Hebrews. What do you think is the biggest question that comes up? Who wrote it? And guess what the answer to that is? Well, we do not know the human person, is that redundant, that God used to pen the book of Hebrews. But do we know who wrote the book of Hebrews? All Scripture is given by the inspiration of God. Who wrote the book of Hebrews? Same person who wrote the book of Matthew, same person that wrote the book of Proverbs, is the same person that wrote the book of Hebrews. That was God. And so the reality is, we don't have to know the penman. We don't have to know the actual person. We would like to, because we know who wrote Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, and we know who wrote the other 26 books of the New Testament, but we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews. Now, if you have a King James version of the Bible, if you have a King James version of, not an app, but maybe the app has it too. Haven't looked at an app on King James version. If you got a King James version of the Bible, what do you have as the title of this book? Does your King James Version of the Bible assign this book to Paul? Does it have that as one of the headings of this book, an epistle of Paul to the Hebrews? Some King James have that as the heading to this book. Kind of unfortunate because we don't actually know if Paul wrote it, but some King James publishers put that in there. But here's what we do know. Can you read that? Good. Here's what we do know about the author just by reading it. We know that he was a Jew. You pick up this book and he uses the first person plural, we and us, throughout the book. As he's writing to Jews, he's including himself in that number. He has a great knowledge of the Jewish system. He has a great knowledge of the Old Testament. Here's an individual who wrote in classic Greek style. In fact, it is kind of a scholarly style. This may sound weird, but for Greek scholars, they say that this book is written in some of the best Greek of the New Testament. Now, we would understand that maybe if we were talking about in English. Are there some documents that are written in better English than other documents? Not that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the other documents were written sloppy or written without professionalism or that they were written like a child. But the level of the language and the style in this book from the Greek language is kind of a cut above some of the other books. He's a man who knew the Old Testament well. He quoted from it, but when he quotes from it, he is usually quoting from the Septuagint. What is the Septuagint? You know what that is? He's quoting the Old Testament from the Septuagint. Septuagint was a Greek translation made in 250 BC of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so instead of quoting from the Hebrew, he would actually quote from the Septuagint. And you say, why does that matter? Well, usually when Paul was writing, we'll mention this in a little bit, usually when Paul was writing, Paul would quote from the Hebrew Scriptures. He was a Jew. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was a scholarly trained man and knew the Hebrew very well. And usually, if he was quoting the Old Testament, he would often quote from the Hebrew. This document quotes from the Septuagint. And you know about this reader, that his readers knew him well. He knew Timothy. Now, the most common person that is stated to have written this book is Paul. If you were to make a list, and I've seen probably maybe 20 different people's names who have been suggested as possible authors of the book. But the predominant individual that's given the most time is the Apostle Paul. And for some good reason, there are a lot of things that there are some similarities. There are, and I say some, not a lot, but there are some similarities between Paul's 13 epistles and the book of Hebrews. And if we had, I wish we had more time to look at some of these. Look in chapter 2 for just a second. Look in Hebrews chapter 2 and drop down to verse 14. And there will be some expressions in here that may remind you of some of Paul's letters elsewhere. Hebrews chapter 2 verse 14. And as much then as the children are partaken of flesh and blood, he himself, likewise, Jesus, shared in the flesh and blood, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Paul spent a lot of time in the book of Romans, the book of Galatians, talking about being subject to bondage. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. And again, if you were to read Galatians chapter 3, there's a lot in there about the seed of Abraham. You read verse 17, therefore in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest. Now, that's where, when you get to this discussion about the high priest, that's where there's going to be some differences. Because we'll note in just a minute, the book of Hebrews has a great emphasis on Jesus being our high priest, and it's not really emphasized a lot in the rest of the New Testament. It's distinct for this book. But there's some other similarities with Paul. If you read the last chapter, it sounds a lot like Paul. He starts making some closing greetings to different people. And so could it be Paul? Maybe. But we don't know. There's a lot of things that point away from Paul. A number of things that don't match his style, particularly the fact that this book is written anonymously. And if we were to go back and look at the end of 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, if we were to look at the closing verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 16, Paul says, especially 2 Thessalonians 3, I'm writing this as I do in all of my epistles, signing his name. And he says, I do that in all of my epistles. Well, we don't have that in the book of Hebrews. Could it be that Paul made an exception here? Maybe he signed his name, maybe he wrote in all of the other ones, but he did not choose to do it here. Could be an exception, but it's unusual that this would be anonymous. Nowhere in this document does the author claim to be an apostle. Did Paul ever claim to be an apostle in his other letters? Yeah, frequently. Claimed to be an apostle, but that is not that's not here. There's not a whole lot of historical evidence if you look outside. For external evidence, there's not a whole lot of it that points to Paul. While there are some similarities, a lot of the language is different. There's somebody, I haven't counted this up, but there's somebody who's counted up 124 words in the book of Hebrews that aren't found in any of other of Paul's epistles. So the vocabulary of the book of Hebrews is a little bit different than others. But look in Hebrews chapter 2 for a second. This is when people are arguing against Paul, and I'm not arguing for or against him tonight. But what happens sometimes is when people are saying, no, it cannot be Paul, they'll go to Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 3, and they'll say, this proves that it was not Paul. Look in verse 2, for if the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just reward, how shall we escape? If we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first, talking about this salvation offered by Christ, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord, who is the first person to talk about this salvation? Obviously, Jesus was. And then it was confirmed to who? Us. Who confirmed the message of salvation to the author and his readers? The end of verse 3. Who confirmed it to them? Who told them about the salvation? It's confirmed to us by those who heard Jesus. When he writes this to them, you read chapter 2 and verse 3, and it appears that the author is writing to a second generation of Christians. Not individuals who had personally seen and known Jesus, but they had heard about and followed this salvation from those who had heard it from Jesus himself. So these readers were apparently not what would be called first generation Christians, those who were right there following Jesus, but were followers of Jesus. And so somebody points this out and says, it cannot be Paul because he says this was confirmed to us, including the author. And I don't know if you can make a strong case for that. Have you ever included yourself in something just to use a we or an us statement just to make people think or make them feel like you were included in it, but you really weren't necessarily a part of that? You just wanted to be inclusive. You wanted to bring it down and help everybody think we're all on the same page together. That happens in Scripture. Not to do it in some deceptive way, but just to, and you're going to see this word we and us throughout the book of Hebrews, to try to make it the readers feel like, you know what? This is, look in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is one of the hardest sections, not one of the most scathing sections. It starts at the end of chapter 5. You remember the end of chapter 5 where he says, you ought to be teachers by now. You're just children. You ought to be teachers by now, but instead, you need somebody else to come along and teach you the elementary principles of Christ. You need somebody to teach you the ABCs. How slow can you be? How far behind can you be in your Christian life that you're not ready to teach somebody? You need somebody else to come and teach you the ABCs of Jesus. That's what he's saying to them, closing verses of chapter 5. Now look in chapter 6 and verse 1. Therefore, leaving the discussion of the elementary principles of Christ. Let's leave that discussion. We should be beyond that. Leaving the discussion of the elementary principles of Christ, what does he say? Let us go on to perfection. Now, was the author himself deficient? Did he need to be taught the ABCs again? Was the author himself not a teacher? Had he not grown as a Christian? Well, obviously he had. But what does he do in chapter 6 and verse 1? He includes himself in the exhortation. And he doesn't just say, you delinquent Christians, you need to grow up. You need to mature in Christ. He's not pointing a finger, you. He's saying, you know what? We all need to do this. And we need to do it together. It's an inclusive us there, where maybe everything did not apply to him. Could be over in chapter 2. And that's really a lot more than I wanted to say about the authorship. Because when you come down to the end of this about the authorship of the book, we can talk about Paul all day long. And at the end of our discussion about Paul as a possible author or not a possible author, guess what we know? We don't know. I mean, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of pages that have been written on who wrote the book of Hebrews. And there are men that have dedicated much of their life to that study. And that's wonderful. But when you get to the end of the day, what do we know? We still don't know. So here's some other individuals that may have, that, and I, like I said, I've seen maybe about 20 names. And some of them are, I don't put up here because they're just people just throwing names out. You know, say, oh, maybe it's this person. Maybe there's no evidence. Maybe it's this person. You know, maybe it was Aquila. Maybe it was Priscilla. Maybe they're just throwing names out, but they have no evidence behind it. And it's hard to find a whole, but there is some support for some of these names, but not necessarily a lot. So what do we know about the author? Well, he's unknown. Well, it doesn't, this is a great quote. You know what? I'm going to read it anyway. I don't have time to read it, but I think it's a cool quote. A.B. Bruce wrote a commentary on the book of Hebrews. And I think this is a balanced way to look at the authorship. We must be content to remain in ignorance. That's hard, right? As to the writer of this remarkable work. Nor should we find this difficult to remain in ignorance. Some of the greatest books of the Bible are anonymous writings. Did you know that? Do you know we have some Old Testament books? We don't really know for sure who wrote the book. Does that affect our faith that we don't know for sure who wrote some of the Old Testament books? He says, it is meet that this one should belong to the number. This book should belong to that number, for it bears witness in its opening sentence to one who speaks God's final word to men. That's Jesus. In the presence of the Son, what does it matter who points the way to him? The witness bearer does not desire to be known. He bids us to listen to Jesus right from those opening verses, and then he retires into the background. I think that's a balanced way to look at it, to say, you know what? This book is about Jesus. It's not about the author, so let's just let it be about Jesus. Now, when we get to talking about the recipients of the letter, we know a little bit more, but we still don't know exactly who this was written to. Who was the book of Romans written to? Church of Rome. Who was the book of 1 Corinthians written to? Church in Corinth. Who was the book of 1 Timothy written to? 1 Timothy. Who was the book of 2 Timothy written to? 2 Timothy, right? Who was Titus written to? Titus. Who was Matthew written to? The Jews, right. Okay, I was just seeing if you were following along with that progression. Now, who is the book of Hebrews written to? It's written to Hebrews. Which ones? Well, there is some element of this that we don't know exactly what group of Jews this was written to. Now, here's what we do know. These individuals were Christians. We just read in chapter 2 and verse 3 that they were ones who had escaped from the pollutions of the world. They had been saved. These were Christians. What do we know about them? We know that they had endured persecution because they were Christians. We also know that these people were well acquainted with the Old Testament. We also know that they gave prominence to Abraham. And so they have as in their background Judaism. That's how they were raised. Much of the evidence of this book points to the fact that that was their way of life before they became Christians, is that they were Jews who had been converted to Christ But now, as you read this book, and we're going to see at the end of the lesson tonight, now that they have become Christians, they are on the verge of leaving Christ and going back to Judaism. Now, that's what we know about these readers. The problem is we don't know exactly which Jewish Christians they were. Look in chapter 13 for just a second. Sometimes, and this is not an accurate way, when you see, I don't know if you've seen charts of the New Testament books and how they're divided into sections. You know the Old Testament books divided into the books of Moses and the books of history and the books of poetry and the books of prophecy. Have you seen that divided for the New Testament? You'll have the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'll have Acts, the book of history. Then what do you have? And there it kind of depends what you have. Sometimes you'll see epistles. Sometimes you'll see Paul's epistles. Usually after you'll have Paul's epistles, you'll have general epistles. James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. What do you do with the book of Hebrews? Do you put Hebrews in with Paul's epistles? Well, we don't know who wrote it. It's hard to put it over there with Paul's epistles. Do you put it with the general epistles? Well, the general epistles are written to a general group of Christians. But this book of Hebrews is not just written to a general group of Jewish Christians. As you read through the book, you're going to find that it's written to a specific group who were in a specific location and they had a specific need. You're going to see that as you read through this book. So it's not just a general epistle to whatever Hebrews might be out there and thinking about going back to Judaism, but it's written to a specific group. And the author was definitely writing to a specific group because there was a connection between him and his readers. And he makes that known throughout the book, especially in chapter 13. But look in chapter 13, verse 24. Greet all those who rule over you and all the saints. And then this statement at the end of verse 24. Those from Italy greet you. What does that mean? Those from Italy greet you. That can mean one of two things. Either the author is writing from Italy, and whoever he is writing to, he is saying, I am sending you greetings from Italy. And that's going that direction, right? To whoever it's going to. Or what's the other possibility? He's writing from somewhere else. And there are people where he is who are from Rome. There are individuals from where he's writing from who are back home. For them is Rome, Italy. And he says in this letter, as he's writing it to those individuals, those people who are with me from Italy greet you. It's one of those two possibilities. Now, which one is it? We don't know. What would seem to be, and underscore that word seem, what would seem to be a better fit would be that he is writing from a location where there are Jewish Christians who were from Rome, and he's sending greetings from them back to those individuals. That would seem to fit perhaps better, but we cannot, again, as with the author, we cannot speak even dogmatically about that, but it would seem that maybe he's writing to those Christians who are in Italy, those Jewish Christians who are in Rome, and there's some other reasons for that, but I'll leave that with you. Any comments or questions or anything you want to say about this fascinating study about the definitive information that we have about who wrote it and to whom it was written? You are just amazed with the declarations that have been made. Dick, enlighten us.
Do we have any estimates of the approximate time that it might have been written?
Dick is a prophet. And Dick, that was the very next point. The timing of, very good question. Dick is my segue man. He's the transition guy. He is taking us from point to point tonight. When was it written? We don't exactly know. Let's put it that way. You read Paul's epistles. Most of Paul's epistles, not all of them, most of Paul's epistles, we know pretty close to when they were written. we can narrow it down to within about a year of when most of his epistles were written. We don't know exactly when this book was written, but here's what we do know. Here's the information we do have. This must have been written sometime prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And why do we say that? Well, because the temple is talked about in the present tense. Temple is talked about is still standing, and the Levitical offerings that are being made at the temple are still being talked about in the present tense, that these offerings are being made. If Jerusalem had been destroyed and the temple had been leveled, would it make sense to talk about the temple and the offerings in the present tense still going on? Wouldn't make sense. So it would seem to say, well, if they're still being talked about in the present tense, they must still be standing, still be active, and so it must have happened sometime before A.D. 70. Now, how long before A.D. 70? Do I have anything up there about the Christians? When you read about these, the readers of the book, and we'll see it. We saw it a little bit in chapter 5. What did he scold them for at the end of chapter 5? What had they not done? They had not grown. Well, would that indicate, did he not say, by this time you ought to be teachers? What does that indicate? Enough time had transpired. Sufficient time had transpired to him for him to say, look, you've had enough time to grow, so would this have been an epistle written early on that these individuals may not have had a chance to grow? If it's written to Jewish Christians in the city of Rome, well, that would help us to pinpoint it a little bit closer. And when you read at the end of the book in chapter 12 and in chapter 10 about some of the impending persecution that was coming down upon them, that could even be a foreshadowing of what Nero was going to bring against them before the destruction of Jerusalem. So 64 to 68, could be 63, but somewhere in that range is where this book seems to fit. Before 70 AD, before all of this transpired with the destruction of Jerusalem, but probably long enough after these individuals in Rome had been converted to allow them time to grow sufficiently as they should have. So that's a good question. Now, here's what I want us to do. I want us to move on from all of this speculation, and I want us to talk about the book. We don't know exactly who wrote it, and that's okay. God wrote it. We don't know exactly to whom it was written. That's okay, because it's in our Bible. So what does that mean? It's for us. We better learn it and study it. God gave it to us to know. And we don't know exactly when it was written, but that's okay. That's not going to be on the final test. So we don't have to have that nailed down. But what is this book all about? If you were asked by somebody, what is Hebrews about? What's the book of Hebrews? Would you be able to give an answer? Would you be able to narrow down a scope of an answer? You know, if somebody asked you, what's the book of James about? Would you have an answer? What's the book of 1 Thessalonians about? Would you have an idea? What's the book of Acts about? That'd be a little bit easier. Pat? Sure. When you read the Old Testament, and I'm going to take a wild guess and say that your favorite book in the Old Testament is the book of Leviticus. That's your favorite book in the Old Testament, right? That's the one that when you're reading through Genesis and Exodus, I'm just going to skip these and go to the book of Leviticus. That's your mindset, right? The problem is that when we start reading through the Bible, we always think we got to read from the front cover to the back cover. So we do real well Genesis, Exodus. We get to Leviticus, and wow, okay. You read about all these sacrifices. You read about all of these events and things that they were supposed to do. You know what a really good commentary on the book of, one of the best commentaries I've read on the book of Leviticus is the book of Hebrews. Understand the book of Leviticus? You want to know why it's, as Pat says, you want to know why that's in the Bible? You know, I understand the Jews needed it. Why do I need it? We read the book of Hebrews, guess what we get insight into the book of Leviticus. And so one of the teachers that I had in school when he taught the book of Hebrews, he would teach first the book of Leviticus, and then he taught the book of Hebrews. Because you will understand the Old Testament better. By understanding the Old Testament, you'll understand the book of Hebrews better. So here you're asked about the book of Hebrews. What is this book about? The last chapter in chapter 13 and verse 22, the writer says, this is the word of exhortation. He tells us, here's what this book is. This book is the word of exhortation. What does that mean? What? You have a book in the Bible and he says, this is the word of exhortation. What does that mean? What's he trying to do? He's trying to urge these individuals. He's trying to encourage these individuals. He's trying to motivate these individuals. He's trying to get them to not go back to Judaism, but not just be focusing on the past, but to focus forward on their steadfastness to Christ. It's a word of exhortation. And so here's what I think is a decent summary. And Pat, what you said is a part of this. Here's what I think is a decent summary of the theme of the book of Hebrews. Here's what he does. It is an exhortation where he is calling upon these Christians to act. Sometimes people read the book of Hebrews and they think, boy, this sounds a lot like a sermon. And it really kind of is. You don't have the introductory, hello, my name is Paul, I'm an apostle, I greet you in the name of Christ, grace to you and peace from God our Father, I thank God for you, I'm praying for you. You don't have that. What do you have? Boom, he just starts preaching. So a lot of this book, somebody said it starts out like a treatise in those first couple, three verses, and then it proceeds like a sermon until you get to the last chapter, chapter 13, and it ends like a letter. Because in chapter 13, you get into all of these various exhortations and then some greetings and salutations that he makes at the end. But the bulk of the book is like a sermon. And in fact, look in chapter 11 for a second. Does this sound like a sermon? Look in chapter 11. Where is this verse? Verse 13. You know what chapter 11 is, right? Hebrews chapter 11. What is that chapter? Faith chapter. What do you have in there? All sorts of examples of individuals from the Old Testament, examples of faith. So he gives these examples. Look at verse 32. And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak. And does that sound like a preacher? I don't even have time in this lesson to tell you about these other people. Wait a minute. If you're writing, I mean, if you're just writing a book out, what do you mean time would fail me to tell? You've got a pen in your hand. You can write as much as you want. And he could have. But under inspiration, he said, time would fail me. There's a lot of, and that's just one expression that I think is interesting to see that's almost a sermon-like. But here is an exhortation to these Christians that is an exhortation to them to be faithful. What are they on the verge of doing? Falling away and going back to Judaism. He exhorts them to be faithful and he warns them. It's an exhortation and a warning. A warning against the apostasy that's coming. And what does he do? He elevates Christ. He elevates the superiority of Christ over everything that they were thinking about going back to. And that's the cool thing about this book is, yes, it helps you understand the Old Testament. Yes, it helps you to have a good commentary in the book of Leviticus. But it will help you to have a beautiful picture of the awesomeness of Jesus Christ. That he is superior, that he is better than everything else that Judaism ever had to offer. So here's what we learn about these people, these recipients. By the time this letter was written, the people that are being written to were neglectful, sluggish, dull of hearing, spiritually immature, careless in forsaking the assembly, and in need of being taught the first principles of God's word. What does that sound like? These people are not doing so well spiritually. They need an exhortation, right? They need an exhortation to faithfulness. These people, when he writes to them, are in danger of what? They're in danger of unbelief. They're in danger of drifting, of casting away their first confidence. They're in danger of being hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. They're in danger of being led astray by false teaching, of returning to the Jewish system, of failing to obtain the grace of God, and they're in danger of missing the eternal rest. What do they need? They need a swift kick in the pants, right? They need an exhortation. says, don't you dare go back to that inferior system of Judaism. Why would you turn your back on that which is the absolute best? And so they are on the verge of spiritual destruction, struggling with whether to continue following Jesus Christ or to return to their Jewish roots. So here's a book that elevates Christ. In your studies of the book of Hebrews, what's one of the key words in the book of Hebrews? The word better. There's 13 chapters in the book of Hebrews. The word better is found 13 times. I don't think that corresponds because there weren't chapters in it when he wrote it. There weren't even verses numbers in it when he wrote it. But it's an interesting way to remember that. 13 chapters, how many times do you use the word better? He is saying that Christ is better than everything Judaism's got to offer. And when we start next week in chapter 1, he's better than the prophets. He's better than the angels. He's better than Moses. He's better than Joshua. He's better than Aaron. He's better than the Aaronic priesthood. He's better than, his sacrifice is better. His service is better. His sanctuary is better. His promises are better. His possession, his eternal possession in heaven is better. And he keeps telling them everything's better. Now, why did you want to go back to that again? Remind me, when you've got everything that's better over here, what was the motivation to go back over there? There is no motivation. And we're gonna run out here. This, when we get into this book, you will, if you've studied this before, I know you've seen this, but the thesis that really is elevated in this book is about the high priesthood of Jesus. And that sounds kind of weird to us if we haven't spent a lot of time in study, because we think about priests and we either think two things. We think about priests and we think, no, not priests, that's Old Testament. Or we think priest, no, that's Catholic Church, we don't have priests. Well, book of Hebrews is about the priesthood. Book of Hebrews is about Jesus being our high priest. And it's an interesting thing what he does. He drops, we saw that in chapter 2, verse 17, he drops the idea of Jesus being a high priest at the end of chapter 2, just for the readers to kind of, in my mind, just for them to say, what'd you say? He's our high priest. And he just drops it in chapter 2, verse 17, and he leaves it. Just a little seed there for them to have. And then you get to the end of chapter 4, and he drops it again. Develops it a little bit more in chapter 4, at the end of chapter 4, verse 14, but then he leaves it again. And you get into chapter 6, and he gives them an exhortation to faithfulness. But then it's not till you get to chapter 7 where he really takes this idea of Jesus being our high priest and spends 28 verses in chapter 7 and then chapter 8 and chapter 9 and chapter 10 just expounding on Jesus being our high priest. When those high priests of the Old Testament, and we don't have time to do this, when those high priests of the Old Testament made a sacrifice, what did they sacrifice? An animal. What did Jesus sacrifice? Himself. He is the high priest. And what was his offering? Himself. When those high priests took the blood in before the presence of God, they took the blood of an animal. What blood did Jesus take? His own blood. Those high priests went into a physical building or tent, tabernacle or temple, one time a year into that most holy place. And they had to go in there every year, because there was a remembrance of sin every year. Jesus went where? He went to the heavenly tabernacle. How many times did he go there? One time for all. How many sacrifices did he make? One sacrifice for all time. Is that better than that old system? So the writer's like, why do you want to go back to that? Remind me again what that's all about. And so 13 times, Jesus and everything he offers is better, 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 better. And tied right along in there with those betters are these hortatory subjunctives, these exhortations, this let us. How many times is let us found in the 13 chapter book of Hebrews? 13 times. Isn't that weird? 13 chapters, better, 13 times, let us, 13 times. Wonder what the key phrases and key words are in this book. 13 times, but notice, remember what I said before. He doesn't point a finger at him and wag his finger at him and say, you need to do this and you need to do this. What does he do? He includes himself. It's not just you that need to grow up. It's not just you that need to hold on to your confidence. It's not just you that needs to strive and to have perseverance. It is all of us. And so 13 times, in order to exhort them, he says, this is a word of exhortation, in order to exhort them and to warn them about apostasy, he says, let us go on to perfection. This is a really cool book. I hope that you will enjoy the study of it. We're going to get into chapter 1 next week and spend some time studying that, and I hope you will look forward to being here. Thank you for being here tonight. I think the bell's rung, so we'll see you on Sunday.